Well, hey, good afternoon, everybody, or good evening. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. And I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. It's a real treat and an honor to welcome Ivy Pakoda on screen to our little program. And she has just an incredible new novel out that I'm sure everybody's heard about already. We're starting to hear about Sing Her Down. Wonderful book. And Ivy, great to see you.
Great to see you, Patrick. You have my favorite bookstore that I've never been to. So hopefully that will change the next one.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Well, it was funny. I was talking before we got started here to Ivy about just how much I love this book. And I have all these incoherent pages of notes. There's so much I want to ask you about.
Let's do it.
But I read the book early on in galley form and fell in love with it. And then yesterday, my wife and I were coming back from LA, and I was reading passages to her aloud as we were driving. It was a really neat experience. I don't really know where to begin, Ivy. I mean, the book is about so many things. You know, it's about LA today. It's about, you know, violence, the nature of violence. You know, it's about society unraveling all around us, you know. And it's about these amazing characters that you've created. The first question, and it's of course about the pandemic some ways. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, had the pandemic already started when you began the book, or did you shape the book around it as it happened?
You know what's really funny that I just realized? I feel like I should have looked this up a second ago. I think you oddly were the first person I told I was going to write this book, because after we did the same talk for Sing Her and for These Women, my previous book, I remember emailing you and asking about Westerns.
Yes.
And you sent me some books, but also gave me a list of Westerns. And that was when I had just come up with the idea of writing it. I'd come up with the idea a little bit before. So I didn't start writing the book until the fall of 2020, which is like big time pandemic here in Los Angeles. We had a very long pandemic. It feels like we had a longer one than other people. So the pandemic wasn't, you know, part of the book in its conception, but as I was writing it, it just became, you know, a natural evolution. Like one of the jumping off points of the book was women in prison. And people can't stay in prison. I'm not gonna write a prison novel. But, you know, I wanted them to get out. And then I realized, oh, of course, there's all this news articles about people being compassionately released for overcrowding during COVID. So that's how it started with the pandemic. It wasn't like I didn't feel initially compelled to write about the pandemic. The pandemic suited the story really well. And, you know, there's a lot of chatter about how no one should write about the pandemic because it's too depressing. And I was like, somebody's going to do that.
Right. Well, it's interesting. We'll go into talking about, you know, the main players here on your mm-hmm. stage. And it opens with the character I find perhaps the most interesting, I don't know, Case. Mm. Or Case, it starts from her voice.
Yeah.
And it's almost, she's almost like an oracle, you know, sort of classic, you know, laying the story out, mm-hmm. a storyteller. Can you tell us a little bit about her, and then maybe we can talk about Dios in Florida?
Okay, I just want to, like, for anyone out there who's watching, the book is primarily about these two other women, Dios in Florida, who are compassionately released during COVID due to overcrowding, and they Dios is sort of like an avenging fury. She's really violent, although she hasn't been as violent as Florida in her past, it turns out, but before she was in jail, really. And Florida is a rich girl who's incarcerated. And the book is really about them and their journey outside of prison.
Right.
Case is a woman who doesn't get released, at least at that point. And one of the problems I had in writing it, I realized, is, now I'm not here to say that unreliable narrators are a bad thing, because, you know, all narrators are unreliable. I'm unreliable when I tell the story of what I did yesterday. You know, I couldn't tell the story of, you know, my last evening, because I don't remember parts of it. It was a big one. I'm just kidding. But to be honest, the problem was, because the book is so tight on Dios and Florida, I needed to give it some perspective, and I needed to say, I needed someone who had a much more sort of step back take of what they were doing. And like, Dios and Florida are like locked in this thing together. And so I needed another character. I had initially wanted something that both nodded to like the Greek chorus oral tradition, which is something that I'm inspired by in all my work. And this book is essentially a Western, not in setting, well, it's set in the West, but it's not like a cowboy Western, but I wanted some of that sort of narration that you get in a Western, like in No Country for Old Men, where the sheriff is narrating the story, and these sort of interstitial segments of him talking about a case that kind of went wrong. And so Case, also a case, is sort of laying the framework for what's going on in jail, but she's not traditional. She hears the voices of the dead in prison. That seems to happen in all of my books. Somebody's always listening to the voices of the dead or the voices in their head. She also has a more reasonable approach to her guilt and her own crimes. Florida is in denial about her crimes, and Dios is like super gung-ho about what she's done. And both of those are unusual responses to violence or to having committed violence. Cases is a little more traditional. So I just needed a bit of a grounding, but she's a very interesting person. I'm sorry to ramble on here. I teach in Skid Row, and I have done that for over a decade. And Cases, the story like Case is a story that most people overlook or don't listen to. She grew up hard, bad things happened. We don't know too much about her. I mean, I do, I don't tell you though. And it's also, you know, she's in prison, and often we just disregard women's stories like that. So I just wanted her to be the, because Florida's story is super dynamic and Dios's story is super dynamic. Case's story is less dynamic, but it's often a disregarded one. So I wanted to make sure that when we're writing about prisoners or people of a different class, that we're honoring them. And her story was a way to sort of do that, to like treat them as human, which they are, and you know, just like you and me, and not a discarded segment of society. So she's sort of, that's her function.
Right. Tell me a little bit about, and then we'll get into it a little bit deeper. Tell me about teaching. I was gonna ask you about the studio. Is it Studio 526?
It used to be Studio 526. We now moved our workshop to the Skid Row History Museum. So it's sort of an independent creative writing workshop for people in and around Skid Row.
Wow. How did you get started doing that?
I used to live in the Arts District, which is east. So the way Los Angeles is laid out, downtown is the first neighborhood, downtown, and then there's Skid Row, and then there's the Arts District. And downtown and the Arts District were both gentrifying pretty quickly. And Skid Row is in the middle of these two areas. The Arts District is like a warehouse district. Downtown is the historic core. You've seen it in a million movies. At that point, there was like a huge downtown revival. I lived in the Arts District, but I did a lot of things in downtown. Every day my gym was there, so I was commuting through Skid Row every day. And I started to notice patterns of behavior in Skid Row. You know, the first couple times you go there, it just looks completely chaotic and completely disorganized. It looks like, you know, if you don't know what you're looking at, you see it looks like people just flopped down in the street, and there are people like that. But then I started to notice there was organization in the chaos, and there was communities on certain street corners, and there was sort of communal housing, and people are sharing materials and tents and cookware. And then one day I was stopped at a traffic light and I saw a bus, and I don't know, this just really struck me. There's a bus and a bunch of people got off the bus, and they sort of dispersed into the streets, and they were going to hang out there for the day. And I just thought, like, well, in my naive estimation, Skid Row is a place that you want to get out of. You wouldn't take a bus to go hang out there. And I was completely incorrect about this. So I watched a documentary about Skid Row that night called Lost Angels. It's pretty good. It happened to be about the organization where I wound up working. I stayed up really late. I had a few drinks, and there was a number, there's an email at the end of the documentary, like, if you want to get involved, write us an email. And I did that, not thinking anything would come of it, and I'd ever follow through. And The next day they wrote me back and they said, do you want to come in and teach? And so I went in and that was it. And I've been doing it forever.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Have you done any teaching in the prisons or?
No, I don't do that. I mean, I feel that that's pretty well covered by other writers I teach in Skid Row. And I feel like there's a lot of focus on, incarcerated writing, stories from prison. I did a lot of reading about, I read a lot of books, testimonials about people incarcerated. There's a really great book called In This Place, Not Of It. It's right on my shelf over there, somewhere, maybe.
This Place, Not Of It, okay.
Yeah, and it's sort of first person accounts of being in prison, which I think is a really nice title. And I read that, and I read a lot of books about prisoners, people talking about their time incarcerated. There's a really great podcast that I think, whatever the public radio station, National Public Radio in Canada did about female prisoners and their stories. So I did a lot of that, but I don't teach creative writing in prison. I have my little network down in Skid Row and I love it. Yeah.
Well, the story kind of opens in prison here in Arizona Perryville, I believe.
That's true. Well, it's never named, but it is named eventually. Yeah. Yeah.
Perryville.
Looks like a Star Wars Death Star from the, absolutely. It's the only place I've ever written about that I haven't been.
You know, it's interesting. Just as a brief aside, I was fortunate enough to go in as a cameraman, which is such a joke because this woman, a friend of mine, true crime author, was writing a case about a female murderess named Marjorie Orban. She wrote a true crime, and I was able to go in and kind of sit with her and take photos. And
I should have called you.
Yeah, it was quite an experience.
Did I get it right?
Just out of some weird thing, this random photo I took ended up on the cover of her book. So,
oh wow,
pretty awesome.
Well, you can tell me if I made any glaring errors about Perryville. No, it's not really Perryville, but yeah.
But no, the whole vibe of Arizona anyway. I thought you captured just beautifully.
Well, I've been to Arizona, and one of the things I'm sort of interested about Arizona, Nevada, California, and the way out there is how interchangeable they are when you're outside the cities. And I really wanted to get that
chain stores, and things like that.
It was really interesting to write about that in the pandemic because they're sort of meaningless, like this whole way of living during that time with big box chain stores. And I was obsessed in the pandemic with these pictures. I looked at tons of pictures of parking lots at malls, which supposed to host like 2,000 cars and they're dead empty, and it's just like the way we use space was completely reconfigured.
And it seemed like also I wasn't in LA during that time, but friends of mine who were, they were talking about, it was incredible, that seeing the freeways relatively empty,
completely empty. No. Really empty. Like you could walk, and that's sort of in the book too. I mean, there's occasional cars. It got a little more crowded. Oh, it was a wild. They were pretty empty,
Let's talk about Dios and Florida in a little bit more detail. Diane Dios Mary Sandoval, love the name. Tell us a little bit about her and where she comes from.
She comes from Queens.
She comes from Queens, yeah. She's tough.
She comes from Queens, and one of the things I don't want, I'm not going to talk about it, but like her backstory isn't who she is. She is who she is regardless. If she was born in wherever, into affluence or in California or in a hippie commune, she would just be the same way. Her violence is not nurture, it's nature. And that's something I want to be really clear about. Her upbringing isn't amazing, but then it becomes pretty incredible in a certain level. She is very intelligent, and she winds up in her youth being given a scholarship to a ritzy prep school in Brooklyn, not the one I attended. And then from there is, able to go to a bucolic New England college somewhere outside of Boston. And what I'm interested in this, the only thing characterological about her violence that comes from this era, her upbringing, is that I volunteer in, and I have for many years taught, I was a professional squash player. And one of the really great things that has developed in squash in the United States, which is a very elite sport, is there are a lot of urban squash programs in which kids who wouldn't have access to the sport are put into a program where their education and sports are nurtured, and they can use that to go to college or to prep school. I have mentored in one of those programs for, I've done this for so long, I don't really want to go into it because it makes me feel old. But in starting to think about this book and thinking about privilege and violence in class, I talked to some of the people I mentored, or particularly the woman I mentored and some of her friends. And I was curious about, you know, what it was. Squash is a very white sport, and the places that they're playing are very white, like the Harvard Club, New York City, you know, Ivy League universities, country clubs. And I asked a question that I can't believe I didn't ask when I was mentoring in my 20s and 30s. What did it feel like to be taken from Thurgood Marshall Academy on 135th Street in Harlem, or and then go to the Harvard Club of New York? And they said they were lined up outside and told not to talk in any way, basically not to talk Black. And I thought I was just shocked. And of course I knew it. I knew this the whole time, but I still participated in this. And there was a lot of code switching and a lot of like, these programs are great. They really, really are. I mean, the opportunities that are available and the success stories, and no one has to go to the Ivy League. You can do whatever. They have 99% graduation rate from high school and college. I mean, it's just phenomenal, but there is a price, and the price is a dissociation from your upbringing and some of the people in your past and your childhood, and a sense that maybe your home life might not be acceptable to the people who are the patrons of the program, not the people who work at the programs, not the. Okay. So, sorry, this is a really long story.
It sounds almost like the Native American boarding schools.
A little bit, except that it's not like we're not changing. You're not supposed to. It's positive overall, but. There is this minor, there's this thing where you have to sort of code switch, and, you know, you have to relearn who you are and or be someone else when you graduate. Dios has gone through that process, and they gave this opportunity to the completely wrong woman, because she is violent, and she is, this gives her reasons for her, violent expression. And she's angry because of what she, you know, it's super privileged. Like, she had this amazing experience and she doesn't regret it, but they gave her the keys to the kingdom and they showed her how to dismantle it, which she talks about in the book. So she is a product of one of these programs, and it fuels her fury. I mean, she has a pretty good job afterwards, but she just has this nature that is getting, it's like the flame is getting turned up under it by some of the things that she's experienced.
Right. There's that, you know, the riff that goes throughout the whole book about, you know, about the nature of violence, and, you know, it's mm-hmm. somehow acceptable that men can have these violent impulses, but we don't, right?
Well, that's the whole point of the book. That's why I wrote it. You know, as you probably know, I'm a huge fan of Cormac McCarthy.
Blood Meridian.
Blood Meridian, yes, yeah, like no problems there. So Dios is lightly based on Judge Holden.
Judge,
yeah. I wanted to give her a name that sort of was that, Dios Mary, just Judge. I don't know why it came to me that way. Dios Mary is actually the name of someone I knew in one of these programs. I have not asked her permission, but I had to Google, are there other Dios Marys out there? It turns out there are.
She's going to show up at your house.
I know, she'll be fine with it. She's awesome. She'll probably be excited. I think Dios is fantastic. I mean, I wish it wasn't such a bloody killer, but like, I just think she's smart, she's intelligent, she's aggressive, she's right about everything. Like, in my mind, she's right. But in promoting my previous book, These Women, virtually, I talked a lot about violence against women, you know, and then I realized in discussing that at length, that violence is really gendered in fiction and in the real world. Like, what Judge Holden can do in Blood Meridian, or what Anton Chigurh can do in No Country, or what Patrick Bateman can do, or any guy in a Bret Easton Ellis violent novel, of which I am a big fan, can do, it doesn't effing matter. Like, we think that they're charismatic and we think that they're cool. And like, Judge Holden has a whole philosophy. And he's like, you know, holding forth on how the history of humanity is the history of war and all of these things. And it's absolutely not justified. It's ridiculous, you know, but a woman does something like that and they're like, oh, she must've been raped or she must've been abused. And the only way we can accommodate ourselves to female violence is to frame it as something that's a result of something a man has done to her. So a woman cannot be violent on her own. A woman needs a man to affect violence on her or in the world. And I hate that because, like, okay, probably for the most part, women are not as violent as men. And probably for the most part, women are violent as a result of some domestic dispute. I mean, that's just largely true, but it's not categorically true. And when women are violent, you know, under their own sail, we can't process it. We do not give them the power of their passions. So I really wanted to write about that. And Dios knows that. Dios is just like, I'm going to do these things and they're going to tell me it's because I was drunk or because I was crazy. And like, even when she's in this like program, she does something kind of violent within it. I'm not sure I put that in the book. I think it's there briefly. And they're like, oh, it's because of your upbringing. Oh, it's because this boy was like harassing you. But no, she's like, no, I just did this, you know? So,
It felt good.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Felt good. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I'm just looking for this note that I wrote. That's I wanted to ask you, I mean, I'm hesitant to get into any spoilers, but you know, the hell with it.
Don't worry. Goodreads and the internet have done it for you.
Have they?
Mm-hmm.
Interwebs. Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, the relationship in prison specifically between the guards and the female inmates or convicts. Mm-hmm. The guards can't hide that they love it when the women throw down, especially when it's a woman like Dios, someone who outclasses them on the outside, but whose status in here forces her to bite her tongue. And they kind of get off on, you know, creating these situations or stirring them into violence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's not a secret that the penal system is a particularly abusive for women. Guards are often take advantage of women for, you know, trade them sexual favors for, you know, basic like necessities. I'm not saying that's always the case, but it does happen routinely. And it's denigrating. Like, it's funny, I actually have a few friends who are working as correction officers and they're great. And, you know, so I feel bad talking about it, but, you know, Dios is troubling to them because she is not your average inmate. She's incredibly intelligent. She's incredibly well-educated and she can run circles around all of these guys. So they love it that she is like a caged animal. I imagined in my mind that she's like a tiger that they're prodding with some kind of cattle rod to get her to act up. And also she's aware of all the injustices going on in the prison. And, you know, she's not gonna fight against them because she's not a social justice crusader. She's not gonna stand up and say, you know, these guys are taking advantage of the prisoners. That's not her, she's not, you know, doing that. But she uses the violence around to sort of insinuate that the women who are imprisoned are weak. That's her thing. She's like, you're not fighting back. You did something to get into this prison. You know, you obviously have done something to stand up for yourself or something transgressive in the past, but now you're a victim of the system. She just hates that, you know?
Right. And there are these very important incidents that happen in her backstory that you kind of tell us about a little bit, where it's almost like her true nature is awakened, mm-hmm. I guess. Do you think that that she has a conscience? Dios.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a true psychopath. I mean, she's not a vacuum. She's not, a conscience is violence in a vacuum. She has a mission, you know? Like, I feel like she has a mission and, yeah, I mean, it's not a great conscience.
But she's
doing the right thing. Like, she really firmly believes that she is awakening. She's also very aware that, like, she and Florida are doomed. Like, in her mind, they're doomed. This is a doomed journey. I don't really know how to explain this. Let's make the most of it. Let's get out of this ride everything we put into it, and let's live our life to the fullest. It's a twist. It's twisted. Her priorities are skewed, but she really thinks she's doing the right thing for Florida. She's like, this woman like she, Florida's a rich girl, white girl, and she's like a lot of the people that Diaz went to college with and prep school with. And she's just like, you know, and she's like them class wise. And then she's like, but you're just going to lie to yourself and your parents are going to get you out of this, but I know who you really are. And she feels in her heart that it is her job to bring out Florida's true nature. So yeah, she thinks she's doing the right thing. I mean, it's twisted, but yes. So she has a conscience.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, there is some sort of loyalty to her tribe, I guess, in a way mm-hmm. too. Well, Florida, yeah, Florence Baum. Mm-hmm. You know, you told us a little bit about her. She comes from this privileged background. Mm-hmm. I love the car and the whole riff on driving.
Oh, yeah.
What driving means to her. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so she grew up in LA and her parents were a little negligent, though that's not why she's the way she is. It just gave her permission to explore her other side. I'd like to be clear about that too. She has a classic Jaguar. And her mom just lets her drive it when she's 15 years old because her mom's just like checked out.
Right.
And it's the one thing where she feels at peace in the world, is the one thing that gives her like a sense of self. And like in my mind, driving is sort of the thing that could have saved her from, you know, going down the rabbit hole of bad decisions. And but she is a person who makes bad decisions and she stands by them. Though by the time she gets to prison, she's trying to deny that, you know, that it becomes more than bad decisions. It becomes her nature. So she loves to drive and she drives all the time. And it's the thing that sort of she's obsessed with when she's in prison is getting back to Los Angeles and getting her car. It's like her last remaining connection to the straight world is this desire to drive. And I just wanted to give her that last sort of human touch. She thinks she's totally normal. She's like biding her time in prison, but like she's not. And if you look at all the things she did in her past, she sort of half seduces an older man. And of course they, you know, he probably took it. He definitely took advantage of her, but she is complicit in this. And she allows, you know, people to say, well, you were 16, you were taken advantage of. But in her heart, she knows that she chased it, you know.
This is Carter.
Yeah. No, Carter's, no, not her drug dealer friend. Her best friend's dad. Okay. Rana's dad. Jan, I think is his name. Jan. Oh, no. Right. No, sorry. No, it's her dad's best friend and her, and also Rana's dad. She puts herself in the way of those situations. I mean, obviously, it's a man's fault for taking advantage of that, but she's seeking it out. But the car is the thing that could have saved her if there was sort of a chance for that. But by the time we meet her, it's too late.
It's too late. Yeah. And there's almost this kind of mythic element to it, you know, about their story, this kind of dance that they go on together. Florida and Dios. You know, without getting too much into the details of it, there's a skeezy CO. This is at the very beginning of the book. Yeah. I gotta say, it's very satisfying. I don't know what that says about me, but what happens?
It says you understood the book.
Yeah, well,
you got it.
It's very satisfying what happens to this guy, you know. So, readers, you're in for a treat.
if you like also,
yeah, you know, and when just the details, let's just talk a little bit about the details of violence. Some of these scenes, and especially in the prison, for instance, but elsewhere, they're very detailed and they're very well choreographed. Ivy, tell us about researching how violence feels, what it looks like, what are the visceral details? You don't shy away from them, which I think is really, probably couldn't.
If Cormac McCarthy can put babies' heads on spikes, I can do whatever the fuck I want. That's my feeling. I was just like, those are babies' heads on spikes. Like, come on. And it felt real. We live in a very violent world. There's violence on, you know, there's mass shootings all the time. And there is, you know, war and there's famine. But especially war and mass shootings. A lot of times when you have a mass shooting, we focus a lot on the aftermath. We focus on survivors and we focus on, you know, the things that are going to help us heal, but we never confront the reality of what happens. We do not show, and I think this is a detriment to maybe getting, not that we need to see this all the time, we don't show what has actually happened. We don't really show the visceral, the blood and the bodies and what happens when an assault rifle goes through someone's body. But we sort of pussyfoot around it. I don't think that should be in the cover of the New York Times, but I do think that these are things that we need to confront as a society if we're ever going to, you know, stop these, you know, horrifying things from happening. Because those are real and they really happened. And I think that anything that really happens and is not superfluous or, you know, written for effect or, you know, cartoon violence belongs in a book. I know, and I don't understand, I knew writing this book, I was just going to put a target on my back and a bunch of people on Amazon were going to say, it was so violent. There was so much cursing. It's like, well, I mean, it's no more violent than anything else. I just explained the violent part. Like, there's violence on TV all the time. We don't technically see it, but we're totally horrific. Like I was just watching, because I'm treating myself to a sick day, I was just watching Yellow Jackets on TV and it's ridiculous. Like these women are hunting this other woman. I'm like, oh, that's crazy. But then we don't see it. And like, oh, that's gratuitous. And thank God we don't. But I feel like we are a culture that loves violence. We love violent TV. We love true crime. We love crime novels. We love these like slasher thrillers. We love I'm not going to point to some of the authors because I do like them and they're my peers. I've read the openings of books where I'm like, oh my God, like I can't sleep. That's so gross. But we never see the actual violence. And I feel like we're going to want these things and consume them compulsively. You have to see it. But what you have to see has to be reasonable. It has to be logical. It has to be realistic. It cannot be played for effect. So that's what I'm doing. Dio sticks a fork into someone's face. I want to see what that looks like. I want to show you what that looks like because that's what happens.
Right.
It's fun to write. Like it's fun to write it without being gratuitous. That's fun, but it's interesting because you don't see it enough. You see, like, I shot him 42 times in the stomach, then I cut off his arm. Like, well, that's, you know, it's not, first of all, if I was a writing instructor, I'm like, well, I'd like to see that a little bit more because I don't believe it. And also I feel like if we're going to confront our aptitude and our hunger for these things, well, damn well, I'm going to give you what you asked for. And if you don't want it, then you should really take a look at why you want all these other violent books that don't show the violence.
Well, and you can't just kind of sweep it under the rug, you know, and pretend like it's not happening.
Yeah.
I think that's the main thing is that people, if, you know, they compartmentalize it or they do it, you know, cartoon violence, as you said, you know, it keeps it at a remove.
Like I watched The Last of Us and it's really violent, but it's like, you know, mushroom people or whatever on HBO or Game of Thrones. Like it's come on, I love this stuff, but like it's not real, like, you know, but we are consuming this stuff in huge doses, but we are unwilling to confront it when it's real, and then that makes me a little bit sick to my stomach.
Well, and also, you know, it's like anybody who's a combat vet or a you know, cop or any other, you know, ER doctor, EMT, whatever, they all have seen something that they can't unsee.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, I'm not going to write another book where it's like even more violent. Like that's not happening. Like, I mean, but I feel that this book does, I hope, make people question if you're uncomfortable with it. And I know people out there will be. And if you're listening, if you're uncomfortable with it, like you should take a look at why you read other mysteries or thrillers, because like there is not a lot of death in this book. There's a couple, like two murders, I think, maybe two and a half. One's in a there's a prison riot. There's not a lot of death in this book. The body count is low, but I do show you what's happening. And so why is that unacceptable? Like I'm always shocked, like when I someone reads like the new thriller from Ivy Pakoda, incredibly violent. I am a big fan of thrillers. I'm like, okay. What is your problem? Why can't you confront the thing that you want? You want it to all be like, I don't know, cozy or whatever. How do you think we fucking people buying cozies? They're getting poisoned at a fucking bakery. And like, do you know what poison does to your body? I mean, please, if you want to know what poison does to your body, I suggest you all listen to like S-Town, that podcast where the poison, like basically on the podcast, you have to listen to it. Like, you know, like confront what you're reading. I'm sorry, not enough. Like, go buy a cozy. But they do die and death is bloody.
And they're always, you know, of the lower classes, yes.
Yes.
Cockney, who...
love lower class violence. Yeah, but like, I mean, it is sort of, now that I'm talking about this, and now my high horse about it, it's like, you know, I can really think of a bunch of books where there's a huge body count, but we don't really care how that person died.
Right, exactly. And also, it you know, I'm just looking at my notes here. This is a sick city getting sicker.
Mm-hmm.
Street is its own local pandemic within the global one. Homicides, overdoses, death by exposure, heat stroke, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That could be the heart of the book beating right there. You know,
yeah.
What's really going on in the city? I don't know. Can you maybe talk about that for a minute or two?
What was going on in Los Angeles during the pandemic?
Yeah.
It was really strange. I feel that it was an odd place to spend the pandemic, because when I think of LA, I think of wide open spaces. I think of a city that's very flat. I think of parks. And you would have thought that this would have been a great place to be on lockdown, but the beaches were closed and the parks were closed. And like all of these things were completely, you felt like you're in prison. We were not, it was weird, because you would think that there was all this possibility of outdoor recreation and space and taking a breath, but it was really, really intense. And crime was escalating. People were going crazy. I shouldn't use that word. People were going, just exhibiting their baser natures. Domestic violence complaints went down because everyone was locked up together with their abuser, which I found absolutely terrifying. But, you know, the book is set during the 4 days of the George Floyd protests. And that was a really interesting and terrifying time in Los Angeles, not because of the protests itself, but because of the National Guard had come to LA. There were tanks in the streets, there were helicopters overhead. So already sort of on lockdown, the city is incredibly silent for 2 years, but now there's these choppers, and in 4 months at this point, June of 2020, there were helicopters flying overhead, and you felt that something really bad was going to happen. And it was really scary. I've never been in a war zone. I do not profess to know anything about being in a war zone, but the closest I felt to being in a war zone was walking down the street, and there's so many choppers that I'm on the phone and I'm talking to someone 5 miles away who's hearing different helicopters, and we can't hear each other. And then a tank rolls by, and just like, and you're supposed to go wait in your house, and there's a curfew. It was very, very scary. And the city was just terrified. We have a huge unhoused community, as I've spoken about a second ago. So there was a lot of fear that the virus was gonna spread from the homeless encampments. It actually didn't. Possibly because they're outdoors. I don't really know. That was much better than people had anticipated. But the city was scary and it was weird. And then during those 4 days, it was surreal. It was completely surreal.
And there's also a lot in the background about, you know, mental health, you know, what was going on, the effect of this sort of collective thing on our mental health.
Yeah.
Mine too, shit. lots of talk afterwards. By the way, I have an anthology idea I want to run past you, if I don't forget. But let's talk a little bit about the wonderful character of yours, Detective Lobos. Tell us where she comes from, what she's all about.
Well, she comes from these women, but she's also in that book.
Shit, I forgot.
Same character. No, I changed.
Totally forgot.
No, I know. It's not your fault. I changed her name because I lost the rights to her name, because I'd sold the TV rights to these women. And I was told that if I wrote another book with her in it, that I couldn't ever sell it because that character goes with the book. So,
oh my gosh.
But when I started writing about two women on the run in Skid Row, I thought, well, I already know the detective who's going to be chasing them. She's in my previous book. So she's Detective Perry. who was having a pretty rough go of it with her husband in that book. And between those two time periods, her domestic life becomes worse. Her husband has done something very bad in the past, was an accident, but he starts to unravel. And what I really wanted to do with her character in both books is, you know, in These Women, it's a book about women who are the victims of violence, whether first degree, second degree, whether they are the actual victim, like the someone who dies or someone who's lived in the wake of violence. And those experiences are not accessible to everybody, but Lobo Perry in that book, or Lobos in this book, they are, she functions as a way, an access point for people who don't feel like they can identify with Dios or Florida, two killers. I think everyone should be able to find some point of commonality with Dios and Florida. I mean, they're really human. They've suffered, they've had triumphs. I feel like we should all be able to find something in common with them. But if you can't, if you lack the imagination or don't want to imagine that you're a killer or an incarcerated, Perry, or in this one, Lobos, she has suffered in a way that I think most women have suffered. Maybe hers is a little more extreme. Although I think many women have suffered way worse. I think the act of being female is an act of violence, or suffering, incurring violence.
Say that so again, what did you
The say? Act of being female is the act of surviving violence on the daily basis. And so her husband has gone a little bit crazy, and he has gone from being emotionally abusive to physically abusive. This is traumatic for her, not least of all because she's worried as a female cop who is on the hook for every misstep she has at work, for every coffee she burns, for every time she parks the car not perfectly. You know, women are on trial for all of their actions. Men are not on trial for all of their actions. Like, you fucking park a car with a man in it and you hit the curb, he's gonna tell you about it. Like, what the hell? Like, you've never done that? A woman would never, we never complain. Like, one of my friends bumps the curb, I'm like, bump the curb, you know, it's human. Everything a woman does is up for scrutiny because men are afraid that a woman's going to eclipse them. So Perry, Lobos in this one is a way, she's changed her name because she's gotten divorced and reclaiming her heritage. And in losing the rights to the character and recreating her, I created the best backstory for her. It was like the best thing that could have possibly happened. So she cannot, in her mind, she's really anxious because she can't keep the peace in her own house. So she's worried that if this gets out, that her husband, she's left her husband because he was domestically abusive, and he's now currently stalking her, that the people on the force are just gonna give her hell about it. Because like, how can she patrol the streets and how can she be a cop when her husband's out of line? And this is like driving her paranoia and making her feel really angry and her hackles are up. And then she's looking at Dios in Florida and she starts to sort of identify with them. Not, she would not kill anybody, but right. She's sort of like, how do they do that? And why couldn't I have in my own way stood up to my husband? So they hold her accountable in a certain way. But I really want, like, I want her to be a reflection of all of these women like myself who just, we accept things. We accept someone saying something really negative and don't push back. And we accept, you know, how I'm like anxious. Like, I play professional sports. I traveled on tour with guys forever. Like, you put your foot in the aisle of a train and they're going to yell at you about it. Like, you spill a drop of coffee, they're going to yell at you. They're going to make fun of you for like putting your racket upside down. Like, so I played professional sports. It was like, you know, so I wanted her to feel the like excessive burden of all the criticism and all the jokes, which aren't really jokes, you know, all. And so that's what she does.
You know, it's funny, I was just talking about this to somebody about how most, and I hate to make a generalization, but most of the women that I know have had some sort of sketchy encounter at some point, you know, not necessarily violent, but the threat of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I have, you know, I had it from someone I knew at a restaurant, like during the pandemic, like the first time I went out to a party afterwards, I was like, never going to party again. Like, it happens everywhere. This guy just followed me into the bathroom and closed the door. It was a friend of mine. And I'm just like, well, Jesus Christ, you know, like this was like a ritzy Hollywood party. And I'm like, this is, everyone goes through this. I told I told a few people about it and they told me their stories, and mine is not, well, we're not gonna go into it, but like, it wasn't horrifying, but, well, it was, but then you just, everyone has been through this, you know, and I think that, yeah, whatever, it's not great. Being female guy is rad, but also kind of sucks. And like, you always have to watch your step. That's the thing I'm really upset about. It's like, there's no room for women to make errors. Like, we see it like the, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings or whatever, like women are on trial just for getting emotional. She's not even emotional, you know? Yeah. Women's emotions are always on trial. And that's sort of what Lobos is doing. Like, she cannot afford to be emotional, but she's very emotional.
And so her husband or her ex-husband, mm-hmm. there have been sightings of him, you know, out in the home. And there are a couple of great scenes in the book where she's kind of sort of looking for him. Mm-hmm. And she almost disassociates at certain mm-hmm. points.
Yeah.
But also talk about her partner.
Easton.
What's your take on him? Is he just kind
great.
Of the typical... the typical dude, or is he more complicated?
He's a really good guy, but she refuses to see it because he's been conditioned by his job and by, statistics to not believe women could do what Dios and possibly Florida have done. And he's not wrong, because in general, women don't do what they did. But he sort of stands in for every man, but his heart is in the right place. And when presented with the facts, he, sees what is going on. But he is a catalyst for Lobos's anger, because she's all over him. She right. cannot accept that he's on her side. She cannot accept that he has her back. He does a great thing for her in the end. He listens to her. He's just like a typical guy. He's not particularly interesting, but he's not a bad cop and he's a good guy, but they're foils, but they're on the same page all the time, except that she doesn't let him get to the page before shutting him down.
Well, you know, now that I think more about him, he actually seems like a very interesting character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of portrayed as sort of this vanilla, you know, he speaks his lines, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
He knows what he has to say, or what he's been conditioned to say, maybe.
Yeah, he's not being given a chance. And like, I also think that if he was paired maybe with a more masculine, bigoted, arrogant cop, he might go that way too. So Lobos is keeping him in line on giving him a huge opportunity to be his best self. But when he is his best self, she just like is infuriated by it and just thinks that he's like, when he says, well, women tend to kill people they know, they don't kill strangers, she pops off at him, but it's just a fact, you know? So she's like, well, that's sexist, you know? It's not, but you know, he's also not looking at the facts. So they're both right.
Right. And she had, you know, she has her own kind of violent tendencies too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, what more can we say? It's really fascinating. What was, when you were kind of writing the book, how did these two voices, I mean, just from a writerly perspective, the way you chose to tell the story, you know, with these different points of view, and how did that work for you?
Well, the book started as a writing exercise because I knew I wanted to start writing something. I hadn't written in a while. These Women was coming out in the middle of the pandemic, the very beginning of the pandemic. And I was sort of, obviously no one knew the pandemic was coming. And so I kind of was waiting for that to come out to start writing. And then I couldn't, because I had to go to kindergarten with my daughter online. So I wanted to I had this idea about a female blood meridian. I just didn't know how to do it. And I didn't ultimately do that, but I started Dios's voice just like the opening of Blood Meridian. And it was like really over the top. And I just had this idea of this woman in prison just like talking. I cut back so much of it. And really? it's not as obvious that's what it is anymore because of the case prologue. But you know, she says, see the tree. She's got this like there's that opening where someone, I don't know who, is talking about the kid. And we see that voice once or twice in the book, or maybe three times. And I'm always like, who is that person talking? You know, is it the author? Is it who's narrating at that point?
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's sort of weird at the end with what happens to the kid. You know, is it the judge? Is he telling the story? So I decided that in my mind, the judge was telling the story of Blood Meridian. It's not correct.
See the child.
See the child. See the child.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, man. See him this, see him that. So they Dia says, see the tree. It's not as exciting. But there's not a lot of things to see in the prison. So, you know, I wanted to write in that style. And then I was like, well, come on, like, you know, that book's a little tiresome at certain points. I'm gonna write my own book. Then I wrote this intro of her talking about Florida, and then I just pivoted to Florida's voice, which for me is pretty easy to do because it's not all that dissimilar from the way I would talk. So was
Portis an influence at all on this?
No.
True Grit?
I mean, I love True Grit, but no.
Yeah, no.
It wasn't really, no. The books that were most influential on it, I would say Hard Rain Falling.
Really? By Don Carpenter?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a prison novel. And the other one, like, the right up front is Dennis Johnson's Angels. I mean, like, that book's fingerprints are all over this book. I'm, like, wondering if anyone's going to call me out on it. Dia even says something basically right out of that book. She asks Florida if she's the fire or the spark. And he has that line in there about depending on which is the candle and which is the light. I love that book. Those are my three. Like, those are the three books that I sort of, and I know people are like, well, you need to maybe find some, you know, female authors. I'm like, well, no, women don't do this. Like, we haven't started. Now we're going to. I hope many more women write like this. I mean, maybe The Mars Room a little bit, though that was, you know, I haven't read it in a while, though I love that book. But Angels was a huge influence. I mean, a huge, huge influence, especially the end of it, when he's being executed.
You know what? I have never read that book.
Oh my God. You won't be able to put it down. It's so good. It's super violent. And no one's like, hey, Dennis Johnson's super violent. What an idiot. Like, I don't want to read this. Everyone loves it, you know?
Angels. Okay.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
I will check that out. Definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In Blood Meridian, there's so many scenes that you kind of think about that come back. I mean, Cormac does get a little purple in his prose sometimes, doesn't he? But the one scene that I really love is it's towards the beginning. You remember when they see the Comanche war party approach, mm-hmm. and all you see are these horses.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I love that.
And then all of a sudden, they all swing up into the saddles.
Saddles, I love that. Yeah,
it's this. You know, one of them's wearing like a blood spattered wedding veil.
Yes. Oh, it's so horrific. That's actually one of my favorite scenes too, because that's where you get it. Like, this is going to be a little over the top.
Right. One's wearing like a conquistador armor.
Yeah, it's interesting because he really plays with something there, which is they're playing with the costumes of the Western world, and but you also get the historical sense of how many people they've killed, and it's really well done. The scene that I really like is when they ride into a town in Mexico after scalped all those people, and they're given this great welcome, and they're fed in, there's a dinner, and then it turns into a complete shit show.
Right.
And I also like the Battle of the Two Jacksons.
I got to reread that book again.
I like everything in that book, even the baby's heads on spikes. That's a great book.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you read by chance Samuel Chamberlain's memoir, My Confession?
No, but maybe I always love talking to you because I'm like, I'm going to have a whole bunch of homework. And that sounds, you know, what is that?
It's one of the sources that he based the book upon. It chronicles this. You'll have to get it. It's about a group of scalp hunters during that time. And there's a really great edition. I'm sorry to digress everybody here.
No, that's fine.
Blood Meridian Land.
You all should listen to this.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful book, My Confession.
Mike, I'm reading it.
It's called My Confession, Recollections of a Rogue. And I know it was one of the source materials that Cormac used for the book.
This is my other nerdy thing about that book. I went to Anza Borrego, which is a state park in Southern California, and it's in a bowl, And like you drive down into this bowl and it's very deserty. And then you can drive up and you kind of wind up on the road to San Diego. You wind up on the road to San Diego. And there's this very, it's very beautiful. And it's very odd. You're coming up out of the desert and winding up in this. Then it becomes very verdant and strange. I'm driving there. I'm like, this is where the kid walks out of to San Diego. I know it 100%. That is right up out of that bowl into San Diego. And I was like, this is so cool. Like, I know exactly where I am and what was written about this place. And he got it. Cormac, you did a great job. You did. It was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, I always get the vibe when I'm down in the Yuma area, mm-hmm. you know, kind of driving yeah. through that part of the state.
If I didn't know that he was going to San Diego, I wouldn't have been so sure. But if there's a description of walking up out of this, you know, place and then the desert falls away and then it becomes green, he could smell the sea. I'm like, yep, been there.
Right. You also teach, as I understand it, out in, I always see you posting out in, you know, Joshua Tree or...
Oh, I teach in the other side of the desert. I teach in Rancho Mirage, Palm Desert.
Now, is that Todd's...
It sure is.
...program? Mm-hmm. He's the best. I love
Todd. I have to stop saying that Todd is the best. I make him crazy with that.
Because he's going to pop up and say something, I'll bet.
No, he was at my party last night. I think he's at home.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah.
And that was at Chevalier's?
It's at Chevalier's, yeah. And then he came and all my colleagues from work came. It was great. I loved the changes they are. Yeah, it's phenomenal. Todd and I went to graduate school together. So we go way back.
That's awesome. Yeah, mm-hmm. I understand he's got a new book coming out this
week. It's so good.
Is it good? Is it the historical and the set in the Salton Sea and all that stuff?
No, it's the conclusion to the Gangsterland trilogy.
Okay, all right.
Oh, it's phenomenal. I just blurped it. It's really good. He's as hell, that man.
Are there clowns in it by any chance?
I've seen that clown in person.
No.
Harpo, yes, he's a real person. He's a real clown. He patrols the Paseo in Rancho Mirage. I thought Todd was making this up. And the first time we went out to dinner there, that guy came in and started to talk to us.
Really? So he
randomly
appears at restaurants? And
in a full-on clown costume. Like, it's not like he put on a wig and some pants. It must take hours or an hour to put on that makeup. It's like a full thing, all the white makeup with the red. It's not 5 seconds, you know? And it's really weird. You'll be sitting at a quite a nice restaurant in Palm Desert and suddenly, or Rancho Mirage, and suddenly this clown pops up. And Todd told me he was going to bring him to my reading last night.
Now, what's the clown shtick? I'm just fascinated by this clown.
Nobody knows.
Is he bumming money? Is he like looking for donations?
No, he is. From my understanding, though, Professor Goldberg would be clearer on this than I am. He is a clown that you can rent and stuff.
Okay.
For parties, though. I don't know who would do that. And he just seems to like to be a clown, but he's not doing anything cute or clownish. He's not juggling. He's not pulling, at least in my experience with him, he is sort of, for lack of a better word, creeping.
In kind of a Gacy sort of way. Maybe not full Gacy, but.
I mean, I mean, I feel like Todd's really smart to have gotten out ahead of the clown story, because like when that guy kills somebody, Todd's like, oh, I wrote the story about him.
Massacre at the Morongo Casino or something like that.
Yeah. Well, no, the Paseo, it's like really weird. It's like filled with like Louis Vuitton and like Gucci. And it's like all these like really, really expensive luxury stores.
Really?
Yes. It's really weird. There he is. Yeah.
That's California for you right there in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody, you must read Sing Her Down. We will have autographed copies of it at the Poison Pen here very shortly.
Very shortly.
Ivy kindly signed a batch of books for us.
Yeah.
And I have made it it's funny, I've kind of resurrected this book club here at the store. The hard-boiled noir kind of.
Okay.
These labels, but you got to call it something. But Sing Her Down is the first pick in my new resurrected club.
I'm so honored.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
This is the inevitable question. A, have you sold the film rights or TV rights for this?
They just went out this week, and with the strike, it's super hard. So we're going to see. You know, I fully expect to. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And what are you working on now? Anything? Have you started?
No. I'm working on just getting
promotion
in the morning. I am toying with two projects. I have a 2-book contract with FSG, and I'm going to write another book that's set in California. Go figure. And I want it to be, I'm trying to make it a little less violent in terms of human-on-human violence, but more about environmental violence. I want it to be almost apocalyptically violent, but I kind of want it to have a family heart. I want to write something that honors my fact that I have a daughter. She is really struggling with the fact that she can't read my books. I mean, honestly, oof. She's found some language in those books. She's like, Mama, what's up? I'm like, oh, Jesus. I might also write a horror novella, loosely based on the Bacchae, which is a very horrific story about a woman who rips her son apart limb for limb in an orgiastic bacchanal.
Some kids just need killing, don't they?
Some kids just need killing, yeah. Damn it, that kid, dude, he got what was coming to him. He got rent. I like the word rent. Rent limb from limb.
Right. Well, do you have, you're probably on to your next Zoom engagement, but do you have a second
after yes.
I go off? I just wanted to ask you something.
Yeah, sure.
But thanks everybody for tuning in today. And again, this is
join Patrick's book club.
Yeah, join my book club. Read the book. Thanks. All right. Bye, thanks guys. Again, everybody. Yeah. All right, let's see here.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.